What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Nisan Bolivinaka, Kamna Maori, have a day and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. We bring our show to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I'm your host, Aggie Dubow, and I hope the weekend treated you well. Joining us here on Monday morning, we've got some stories for you. The latest on surgery on conjoined twins from PNG. Well, it's the monthly cycle that most women dread, but how much more for our Pacific women with disabilities? And will we see a Pacific nomination for the Oscars? All that and more shortly, but I say mahalo nui loa. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We start this morning in Sydney, where after 7 hours of surgery, surgeons at the Sydney Children's Hospital separated Papua New Guinea conjoined twins Sawong and Tom. But sadly, one of the twins, Tom, passed away following Sunday's emergency surgery. Hilda Wayne from the ABC's One Talk program has been following the latest developments. Hilda, good morning and welcome to the show.
Good morning through, Aggie. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Well, look, I know, Hilda, you wrote the first ABC story on this when the twins were flown out from Morobe to Port Moresby and again now more recently to Sydney. Hilda, what do we know about the emergency surgery?
Yes, the surgery, according to the hospital and Captain Eugen Rowe, is with the family at the moment in Sydney. It was planned for this week, probably. It was planned for tomorrow, Tuesday, but they had to rush and do an emergency because one of the twins, Tom, was not doing so well. And that was the case since they left Morobe, Finchafen. And I've spoken to the mother throughout, and Eugen Rowe as well. The mother was saying the same thing. Tom was the one that was needed more help while Sawong was doing well. So that was the news we got yesterday, that after the surgery yesterday, Tom sadly passed away. And Sawong is now is one of the surviving twins now, and is they under the care of the hospital. And all this information that we got is from Eugen Rowe, who has been with the family from the beginning since they left Winchafen, and also followed them to Sydney, and is in Sydney with them. So we'll just hear from Eugen Rowe and the update he gave to me yesterday.
It was on Saturday lunchtime when the doctors called us in and they said, look, Tom is getting more swelling and he's basically going downhill. And initially they were planning a planned separation for Tuesday. But they said it looks like we have to bring it early, maybe tonight or maybe tomorrow morning, just to see how he goes on Saturday. And then we sent all the consent forms. And then the evening they told us we're going to start tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock, take the baby down, 8 o'clock, start operation. So, and that's what happened. So it was a 7-hour operation before Tom was separated from Sawong, and he basically died within minutes afterwards. Once we were here, they were able to do more research on how they were connected and the complications. And then once they had shown us the research they had on their condition, we knew there were like more than 3 reasons why he shouldn't survive. Yeah.
And that was Eugen Rowe, who was instrumental in bringing the twins to Port Moresby for treatment. Hilda, what do we know, is going to happen now with the surviving twin?
Coma at the moment. And Again, I'm quoting Yugun Ro. The hospital have mentioned to the parents and him that they will keep Sawong under intensive care for at least a week or two, and then they'll see. But right now he's in good care at the Sydney Children's Hospital, he's in a coma at the moment.
Now, Hilda, I know the parents have asked for prayers during this difficult time. Like, yeah, what has been the response like?
It's been great, Aggie. This is a story, you know, since it broke, has really brought people from all walks of life, not just in PNG, but everywhere, who have really been praying and watching out for this story and hoping for the best that both twins make it. But it's not the case this morning, but people have been praying for the twins and for the parents and, you know, for the medical specialist in Sydney and also in Port Moresby when they were there that, you know, the children, the twins will make it. And so it's been really great to see that people are upholding the family in prayer and the twins in prayer.
Yeah, Hilda, as a Papua New Guinean, what's your view been about the story of these two twins? Like, now that it's just Sawong left, like, I know, as you said, you know, their journey certainly captured the attention of the nation, right?
Absolutely, Aggie. And when I first brought the story onto the ABC and then, you know, back in PNG as well, the local media, and then our colleagues Tekla Gunga and Miriam Farr following up, you know, really great follow-up stories, you can see from the ABC Facebook page that it not only just united Papua New Guinea, but the Pacific and Australians too have been responding and hoping for the best. And it's united a lot of people. And it's so wonderful to see that, you know, people can come together for a story like this. But this morning, is the news that they will get is that one of the twins has made it. So that's a story that they'll hear this morning.
Definitely, Hilda, thank you very much for bringing us this story, of human life. And obviously we just give our love and prayers out to the parents there of Tom and Sawong, but just healing, I suppose, for Sawong so that he can become very strong. But yeah, thank you so much for bringing us this story, Hilda.
Thank you for having me, Aggie. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. That is Hilda Wayne, our One Talk reporter here on Pacific Beat. Now, the Australian town of Leeton is fast becoming a well-known destination for Pacific seasonal workers, especially those disengaged from the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme and who are seeking help. As we covered last week, Leeton in New South Wales is providing home for seasonal workers. As Lucy Cooper reports, the town could provide a model for other rural centres.
Towns across regional and rural Australia are grappling with disengaged workers, labourers who have left companies they were recruited to work for under the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility PALM scheme. Their visas are tied to their employer, so if they leave their job, their visas can be revoked. Since 2019, more than 7,000 workers have disengaged from the scheme. Many remain in Australia on bridging visas or are undocumented.
The government has largely left these workers, these people who've left the PALM scheme, who are in these really vulnerable and precarious situations. The government's completely ignored it.
Kaya Barry, an academic with Griffith University, recently co-authored a report looking into their situation.
We know that there's thousands of people out there who need support, but you know, once they're formally exited from the PALM scheme visa, it's like everybody turns a blind eye.
But there is one town wanting to change this.
You might see as you drive in, we have a sign, don't we, saying we welcome immigrants and refugees and new settlers. So they know we've got open arms.
That's George Weston. He's the mayor of Leeton Shire Council.
We've got a great heart. We have a multiculturalism organisation who go out of the way. They take them to the hospital. They look after them. They help them with filling out forms at our local library to try and get their visas organised, try and give them as much information as possible.
Home to about 9,000 people, Leeton is about 6 hours from Sydney. It's located in the Riverina region, known as the Food Bowl of New South Wales, a crucial agricultural region putting food on the plates of millions of Australians.
We can help them. we can look after them, we can use them, and Australia can use them as well.
Leeton Shire Council is a founding member of the Mayoral Alliance for the Pacific, which aims for better outcomes for Palm Scheme workers and the communities they work in.
We're trying to lobby the federal government. There's DFAT and Dwyer and Home Affairs, because they're all just different silos, and we're trying to get them together and say, hey, we've got a problem here. These people are worthy people, or they've been disengaged, but how about we get them back into the workplace? You know, can you reevaluate and look at it?
Most of the disengaged workers in Leeton have moved there through word of mouth. Seeking connection and support, Leeton welcomes them with open arms.
It makes me really proud of Leeton, the welcoming that we do. Every individual here go out the way to help people. It makes me feel really great.
And it's not just the council which is pushing for better outcomes for disengaged workers.
We get the fallout from the Palm Scheme from other locations where they come to Leeton. I will give my 100% support to Palm, but I can't support something where I see the failings that I believe we can address.
Paul Matem was the mayor of Leeton for 16 years and now leads the town's multicultural support group. He's long advocated for greater support for workers under the Palm Scheme who feel they have no choice but to leave.
They've said they're too frightened to speak out because they're worried that they'll be sent back home, and in some cases been told that they will go home. There'd be a huge void if suddenly they all had to go home. So if we can make it work, we can find a pathway, and we need to give them confidence that they can sit down and talk to not only people like myself, but others that we're connected to within Home Affairs and others to say, let's find a way.
He started briefing the new workers who come to Leeton under the Palm Scheme. He hopes these meet and greets where he chats with them about the local sport teams and where to seek help if they're struggling will keep more workers in the scheme and reduce disengagement.
I'm just an ordinary guy, and I just feel that, you know, you can sit down and talk to these people, smile with them, help them along the way as much as you can. And I think they have that trust then. And when they have trust, they don't have fear. And if they got fear, well, obviously things don't work as we'd love to see them work.
At JBS Riverina, a beef feedlot, farm and processing facility, Palm Scheme workers are a crucial part of the workforce. Inorke Knox Coloni Singer works at JBS as the Palm Support and Engagement Officer.
We believe in the workers' welfare being paramount and very important to our production as well. If the workers are looked after well outside of work, it will show on the numbers at work as well.
From Fiji and Samoa, Knox said his background helps him understand the workers better.
I know their backgrounds because I was from there and I live here as well. So if there's anyone that could help integrate them into the Australian community, that would be someone like me, someone who lives in both worlds.
Paul Matem hopes these roles and ideas which Leeton is trying to implement will become a model for the rest of the country.
We should never, ever, ever have that a person is fearful for their job.
Report author Kaya Barry is calling on the federal government to implement reforms to keep workers in the scheme.
This has already stretched on for years for some of these people who are just off the grid, really vulnerable, in pretty horrific conditions most of the time.
A key one is mobility, allowing for workers to easily change employers in the scheme.
Mobility is the operative word. I mean, and to be mobile, you need to be able to move from one employer down the road to the next employer. If those amendments were made to the Palm Scheme by the government, then that would be something which could be looked upon, I think, quite favourably.
That's Michael Pyers. He's the General Manager of Workplace Relations and Legal Affairs with the National Farmers Federation. He said it would be timely if a review into the operations of and lack of pay transparency associated with labour hire companies were to occur.
If you do nothing and if you just leave it as it is now that your visa is tied to this particular farm, then if the palm worker is unhappy, they will disengage. They will take matters into their own hands anyway.
The chance to easily move between employers is also endorsed by the workers themselves. Wayne Levy from Solomon Islands said he would never have left the Palm Scheme if he just had the opportunity to change jobs.
If I can go back to the Palm Scheme, no problem. Yeah. So I enjoy the work. I want to just earn money to support my family. But the problem is that one. Yeah, there is no transparency at all when they're doing the pay and all these things.
And that's Pacific worker Wayne Levy from Solomon Islands, ending that report from Lucy Cooper, who worked with Douglas Dingwall and Catherine McLoone on that investigative report.
Want the latest Pacific Rugby League and Union news and interviews with stars of the game? Tune in to Nation Footy with Sam Wykes and Tinirau Arona.
He is an absolute beast, man. He's like UT. It's your size, but just probably about 10 kilos
wider.
Wider, thick. Yeah, thick type of bloke, yeah. That's fast. There's so everything opposite to you.
Like Nation Footy, Monday afternoons at 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Whakawhitai, Lassie, welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, Sunday marked the 50th anniversary of Indonesia's invasion of Timor-Leste. The invasion came just days after Timor-Leste declared independence following the departure of its longtime colonial master, Portugal. It's estimated more than 100,000 people died in the two decades of occupation, many from conflict and famine. Despite the passage of time, the memories of those dark days remain fresh in the minds of survivors. Vonya Vieira reports.
Marta Ribeiro dos Santos was 33 years old on December 7, 1975, and can remember plants filling the sky.
What I still remember is that the planes parachuted down on December 7th, which was a Sunday. I saw dead people around my house, and more planes were flying around.
Marta saw many warplanes flying, and she didn't know where to go.
Yes, the Indonesian warplanes were coming. We were also afraid and wondering where we could go. We wanted to run and hide in the clinic near the house.
For Marta and the Timorese, the invasion was only the beginning. 24 years of brutal Indonesia occupation follow it.
I faced a lot of suffering. Children had difficulty finding food and there was no water to drink. Life was very difficult. I'm lucky to still be in this house. But going to school was also challenging after Indonesia arrested me and put me in jail.
Indonesia launched its invasion following a period of political turmoil and instability in the region after Portugal withdrew in 1974. It is estimated that around 2,000 to 3,000 Timorese people were killed during the military assault. It's been estimated that during Indonesia 24-year occupation, which lasted until 1999, between 100 and 250,000 people were killed. José Barreto de Jesus is another survivor of the 1975 invasion. He says, at first people were confused.
When the paratroopers landed, we were in Dili. When they landed, we didn't know what parachuting was. Our friend said that the plane was dropping balls. We went down. I shouted that the plane dropped parachutes.
When it became clear what was happening, Jose says people fled the capital.
Dili is abandoned. People are leaving. We can say that 90% of Dili is empty. People are running away. No, I'm not afraid. My only principle is that you have to fight against the invaders. I don't think about anything else. I lost wealth, lost people, lost family, lost my sisters.
Activist Amandina Helena da Silva wasn't born when Indonesia forced to control of the country. But he says her generation is grateful to those who persevered through the brutal occupation and continued to fight for independence.
Particularly, I describe this as the sacrifices. Because, you know, when the Indonesian invasions in Timor, at the moment, a lot of people, including women, die. And not only die, but a lot of aspect they face at the moment. So for me, this is sacrifice.
She says women in particular paid a heavy price, and the trauma is ongoing.
A lot of women face several and systematic structured violence, not only the physical violence, but also emotional violence and also sexual violence, particularly to the women survivor of sexual violence, because right now they are getting old, and some of them already passed away. And some of them now survive on the illness, cancer, like vaginal cancer, uterine cancer, the mental pressure, the trauma, they still face this kind.
Marta Ribeiro dos Santos says, if the wounds from those dark days are to heal, Indonesia must acknowledge the atrocities its soldiers committed.
I want to tell the Indonesian government that there must be justice. The places where they killed many people must be identified so that we can recover their remains and bury them properly. And that there is Marta Ribeiro dos Santos, ending that report from our Timor reporter, Vonia Vieira.
Pacific Beat.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Dubol. We're talking menstrual health, and for women across the Pacific, it's often rarely spoken about, and guess what? Even more so for people living with disabilities. Many of these women face barriers to basic sanitation, affordable menstrual products, and even exclusion from education about their own bodies. Now, a recent report from Silence to Solutions explored the experiences of these women from Fiji, Papua New Guinea, and Vanuatu. Its co-author, Hannah Tamata, from the Pacific Menstrual Health Network, joins us this morning to highlight their findings. With that, I say good morning, Hannah, and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Good morning. Morning, Pro.
Thank you. Thank you very much for joining us this morning, Hannah. You know, firstly, when we talk about a woman's monthly menstruation cycle, periods, you know, I know it's a very sensitive topic for many and probably often taboo across the Pacific, but more so, you know, women with disabilities. Hannah, what was some of your key findings around this?
Thank you, Abby. So our key findings, this report was very dear to our heart, and it actually started from a discussion where we found out that around the circle, when we talked about menstruation, women with disabilities were not speaking up or not represented well around the table. So we decided to take a deeper dive and find out what are the real issues that women with disability across the Pacific face. And one of the some of the key findings that we found were that some real great and practical recommendations, actually they came out from this report, and some of those findings were like common across all the three countries that we did the interviews in. And a central finding is that OPDs and women or organizations for people with disability and women with disabilities need to be central to define the solutions. Another key finding recommendation is for information and education on menstrual health to be included in the tracking of disability and discrimination, and to include menopause information. That was a huge topic that came out. Yes, we can talk about menstruation, but we also have to talk about menopause as well. And this more awareness and information around this needs to be included for women with disabilities, not only women with disabilities, but also for their carers. And that was a key finding that came out, that carers need to be educated or informed how they can help their person under the responsibility who have a certain disability so that they can help them to manage and also take care of them when they're in menstruation or in menopause. Mm. Those were the key findings that came out here.
Well, yes, and I do want to get to that menopause topic. But before that, were you actually surprised by any of these findings?
Yes, we were very surprised because we were more focused and thinking around people with disabilities. Not also, we didn't really think too much around carers, but also thinking about some of the carers are also women who menstruate and also have to help and support those under their care who also menstruate. So it was interesting to also think about that as well. So we were very, it was a heartfelt and emotional report to participate in.
Yeah. Well, Hannah, what was sort of significant about the three islands, you know, when doing this report? I mean, why were these three countries chosen?
These three countries were chosen because we have, through the Pacific Menstrual Health Network that WaterAid Australia supports, we have presence in Fiji and Vanuatu and also in PNG. We wanted to have a larger audience, actually, but we were short in time and thought about what was more realistic. And that's why we chose Fiji, Vanuatu and PNG, because our presence was strong in these three countries. Mm. Also, we also considered that this report is a special report because we wanted to have peer-to-peer sort of method in finding these information. So we had to also check if the OPDs in these countries were strong so that people with disability could actually be interviewing people with disability. So we took that focus, and that's something that Pacific Disability Forum based in Fiji were very strong on. That method actually worked well in Fiji, PNG and Vanuatu. There was a bit of stretches with commitments from the OPD in Vanuatu, but there was a lot of support from the OPD as well to review our questions and stuff like that. So that is the main reason why we chose those three countries.
Nice. And look, even in your findings, when I was sort of reading through the report, it showed that like nearly half of the women interviewed had not even received any menstrual health education before their first period, which was really, really fascinating to read about. But so what do you put this down to?
Well, it's very common, as you mentioned in the findings, the discrimination against people or women with disabilities. They are normally the last people we think about, and their slogan says do not leave us behind. So also they're the last people that we think about to give awareness to inform them of certain change, well, I wouldn't say certain changes, but to inform them on all information that is happening around them. But we forget to also inform them of the changes that can happen to them as a female with their body as they enter into puberty, as they enter into menstruation, and then later into menopause. We forget about this. And that's the main reason why we were sort of expecting this to also pop up as well. I think there was about 70% women who were interviewed that did mention they did not have any awareness on menstruation or menopause in the interviews.
Wow. In terms of like, you know, menstrual products, right? Like what does the lack of that sort of actually really look like for women with disabilities in the Pacific?
For women with disabilities, it's very challenging when you're talking about products because it really depends on your disability. So what type of product you would need is very important, and that's not considered in the products that are currently being supplied. Yes, and also it also... That's the main challenge I can think of because... there has to be special fittings determined on what their disability is. And also we do have issues around climate change and reusable pads and everything. So disposure of pads is an issue as well. So we're trying to push for that so that reusable pads can be created that will fit women with disabilities so that they can be created specially for their needs. And that's something that which we're hoping that maybe can through this report we can influence some of those decisions so that women and disabilities can be their products can be also considered as something that needs to be given to women with disabilities. Already in Vanuatu, PNG, and Fiji, products for everyday users is also not prioritized, often not prioritized as family within the family budget. That's the, sort of the last thing people think of to buy, and tend to be not thought of that important to buy until someone is on menstruation, and even the stigma to go purchase in the shop is also something just to go there and purchase and come back. You have to hide and everything. So how much more for women with disability? That's the question that we have there, and we don't have an answer for right now.
Well, Hannah, when we talk about, so again, understandably with women who are currently going through menstruation, It's now, you know, that part of life, though, when we come to menopause, which I know that's something very close to my heart too, myself. So I'm just wondering, how have women with disabilities been able to navigate that space?
Actually, when we started this interview, we weren't thinking too much about menopause until one of the participants actually mentioned that, oh, I'm no longer having my menstruation, I'm on menopause. So then we thought, okay, let's explore this. And it was interesting to see that the change is not knowing much about menstruation and then getting having to be dependent on somebody to look after you, and then all of a sudden it stops, and then you're not sure what's happening to your body. You have all the emotions, you have all the mixed feelings coming in, for some women, they don't know how to express and get more help, where to go to, what does my government, what are the health services that my government provide, or the mental care that I need to help me go through menopause is something. And I think for women with disability, not only for them, across the Pacific, menopause is a topic that is now being talked about very, like, it's now the topic. And there's not much information there to help women to help women who go through menopause. And then if you think about women with disability, they're stepped down, so there's not much information for them as well. So it's very challenging for them. Most Pacific countries are also improving their services, their government systems that help women with disability. So it's a good opportunity right now through this report to influence those systems to also think about, we have to think about women with disabilities who menstruate and menopause as well, as we make these new services for them as well.
Nice. Hannah, look, we're going to have to wrap up, but this is a very important conversation to have for our women across the Pacific, especially those who, you know, are dealing with some type of disability. And like the report is titled, From Silence to Solutions, what are some of those solutions? Like, what are some of the recommendations from the report?
So from this report, as the Pacific Menstrual Health Network, as WaterAid, as our supporters, as Pacific Disability Forum, we're calling for empowering of partnerships with local organizations for people with disability to make sure that they are central to menstrual health solutions. So that means that we have to also consider including them into the discussion so they can make decisions for themselves, what is best for them, and to also have cross-learning between countries across the region, the Pacific region, to learn what is happening, how can in different countries, and to learn from each other. We also want to improve access to menstrual health information, including about menopause, which reaches women with different types of impairments, as I mentioned, and hearing and seeing as well. So the different disabilities. So it can't be standard. It has to fit all the different disabilities. We're also calling for information for carers about how to support women with disabilities to manage their menstruation and menopause, also considering the impairments are different across all disabilities. So, and then lastly, we want to call for better health services, which are safe, accessible, and non-discriminatory, and that are skilled at improving or providing menstrual health and menopause information and services across the Pacific.
Well done for the work that you guys have done, Hannah. Really appreciate you coming on the show this morning to have this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
No worries. That is co-author of the report, From Silence to Solutions, Hannah Tamata from the Pacific Menstrual Health Network.
Join Jacob McQuire and Michael Chow for Nisha Daily every weekday morning on ABC Radio Australia.
Hey, real quick, what's 2 plus 2?
I'm assuming. that's 4.
Oh. Wrong. 2 plus 2 is window, Aggie.
Wow. Oh my gosh. I have not done that
two
since
plus
I was
two is window.
In this primary.
What if my mic drops?
Nisha Daily, weekday mornings from 7 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia. We'll be right back.
What's up, ABC Radio Australia listeners? I'm Sosafina Formoli, and I want you to come hang with me for On The Record, your weekly deep dive into the music that moves the Pacific. We'll talk about the big tracks that inspire your favourite Pacific music artists and the real stories behind them. Plus, we'll uncover some gems that you might not know yet, keeping the heart of the Pacific alive and thumping. Catch On The Record Mondays at 3 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Malo dama e bombongini, welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Tupol. We head to Samoa, where the residents of Sawhata are still waiting for compensation after the sinking of the Manuanui, a New Zealand Navy vessel. Although New Zealand has already transferred the funds, Samoa's government has not released them. And officials say payments would come after the national budget passed, but no date has been given. Locals are urging the government to deliver the $10 million compensation without further delay. Sawhata resident and Member of Parliament Tuia Pai Pai Letoa speaks.
As of now, nothing has arrived. It was promised that once the budget was passed, the compensation for the district of Sawhata would be delivered. So we are trying and writing to the government regarding the $10 million compensation for the district of Sawhata. As of now, the study and investigation have already been done, and only the district of Sawhata was affected. People of the district are confused and uncertain. There's talks about what has to be done with the $10 million, but that $10 million is supposed to be the compensation for Sawhata. The compensation should be given directly to the beneficiaries. The beneficiary of the $10 million is Sawhata. Let Sawhata distribute it.
And that there is Sawhata resident and Member of Parliament, Tuia Pai Pai Letoa.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, the annual Melbourne Pacifica Festival took place over the weekend with thousands in attendance. It featured traditional performances from local Pacific Islander dance groups, but the festival also displayed contemporary music from upcoming artists. The most notable among them being Tahitian musician Aramistic. He's not well known outside of French Polynesia, but his unique musical style has earned him invites to festivals around the world. Whenua Whenua spoke to Aramistic following his performance at the Melbourne Pacifica Festival.
My name is Arimiti, alias Arimistic on stage. Initially, I do a lot of reggae, and then in Tahiti, we started exploring other genres and just having no barriers, really. But my specialty is to integrate Tahitian percussions, traditional percussions, and also the vivo nasal flute in those new songs.
And you came all the way from Tahiti just for this one event?
Yes, I came all the way just for this performance. I did 2 days travel, and now I'm going back again 2 days travel through New Zealand and then Papeete. It was actually the Women Federation that got in contact. I got in contact with them, and then they tried to invite me for last year's edition of the festival, but it didn't happen. And so this year is the first time I managed to come.
How does it feel to represent Tahiti here?
To be honest, I feel a little by myself, but I'm really happy that I managed to do this and to meet the communities here and to see the Pacifica in Melbourne. I'm really happy to have done that.
That last song, you were talking about Tahiti, and that last song, can you describe that?
Yeah, the last song is called Atomi Testing. So it's about the 193 tests that the French government did in the island of Moruroa in French Polynesia in the 90s. That's one of the subjects that I really wanted to talk about. It's not always political, but it's just that this subject came up, and I think it's a good thing to remind this through music.
And that was Aramistic, Tahitian songwriter at the Melbourne Pacifica Festival. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. It is that time where we head around the region to get the latest headlines, and that's brought to you by our producer, Whenua Whenua, who's in the studio with me. Fefe.
Sorry, but again, I'm fine, thank you.
I'm going to say, I can't believe we were both at the Melbourne Pacifica Festival, didn't even see each other.
Yes.
But did you enjoy it?
Oh, yeah, loved it.
Love the food.
Food was great.
Absolutely. Hey, talking about the Pacific, we begin in Samoa because, goodness, we're hearing reports of an alleged leaked document. Now, the draft government document that outlines sweeping new restrictions on journalists. What's happening?
Yes, this is according to the Samoa Observer. They're reporting they've verified a leaked 19-page government media protocol that proposes sweeping new restrictions on how journalists questions the country's leaders. Samoa Observer reports the document begins with a requirement that all media submit their questions a full day before the Prime Minister's weekly press conferences. Wow. And includes proposed background checks on the, quote, political alignments of reporters. And this comes, as we've reported over the last 2 weeks, Samoa Observer being banned from Prime Minister press conferences. This draft basically gives the government near total control over the scope of questioning concerning news, of course.
Yeah, very concerning. But we'll keep our eyes and ears on that one. Also, I think we head to sport because I believe Fiji narrowly missed out on winning the Cape Town Sevens tournament.
Yes, that's right. The whole South Africa ended up winning the tournament. They beat France 26-17. Fiji narrowly missed out when they lost to France in the semifinal 19-17, but they definitely made up for it, thrashing Spain 47-10 in the third place final. For the women's tournament, Fijiana, well, they didn't perform as well. They ended up in 10th place out of 12 teams, losing to China in the 9th place final, 14-12.
Oh, wow. Goodness. That's crazy results there. But look, well done for all our Pacific teams. I want to talk about boxing. Goodness, Samoan Australian cruiserweight Jai Opetsaya. There were concerns, though, after the opponent he knocked out over the weekend was on the canvas for like 7 minutes. Yes. What's the latest update there?
Over 7 minutes, the 40-year-old German boxer Hussein Sincara. He's recovered in hospital, but there were concerns about him when he was knocked out unconscious and laid on the canvas for more than 7 minutes.
Yes,
I did. It was a very powerful right hand by Jai Opetsaya. His fight lasted much longer than predicted. Despite the strong showing, he was disappointed in his performance. Downplayed himself a lot. He wanted to put on a very strong display. He wants looking for big names in the divisions, big purse fighters.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's something we'll be looking out for too. But for now, as always, thank you so much for bringing us the latest on NewsWrap.
Pacific Beat.
Well, it's not often we see Pacific films at the Oscars. 20 years ago, Māori filmmaker Taika Waititi was nominated for Best Live Action Short Film, Two Cars, One Night. Then there's Disney's Moana, who picked up two nominations for Best Animated Feature and Best Original Song in 2017. That same year, the Australian Ni Vanuatu film Tana made it into the Best Foreign Language Film nominees. Now, two Kiwi Tongan filmmakers are looking to break that 8-year dry spell at next year's Academy Awards. Luciana Buchanan is the star of the hit Netflix series The Night Agent and more recently starred in the Jason Momoa's Hawaiian epic Chief of War series. Now, she's teamed up with Vea Mafileo, an award-winning documentary filmmaker, to create the short film Lea Tupuanga or Mother Tongue. Written by and starring Buchanan, it's about a young speech therapist who is disconnected from her Tongan heritage and lies about her Tongan language skills to get a job. Alice Lorihea spoke to the two filmmakers about their journey to the Oscars.
Milo Lele, Luciane and Vea, thank you so much for joining me to talk about this momentous occasion. I'll let you ladies share the news with our listeners.
So a short film that has had a very long life, Lea Tupuanga, Mother Tongue, written by myself and directed by the amazing Vea Mafileo, is in contention and is eligible for the Academy Awards for Best Live Action Short, which is really huge. No Tongan film has gotten to this point. The last New Zealand short nominated in this category was Taika Waititi's first short film, Two Cars, One Night, which was nominated 20 years ago. And so to be, you know, kind of without tooting our own horns, making history in that way, that's all just a cherry on top. And yeah, it's exciting.
Vera, when you first read the script, when you spoke with Luciane, what was the pull for you to come on board this project and make this your first drama debut?
It was probably, first of all, because Luciane is fellow Tongan lady. And for me, it's really important. You know, it's always been my kaupapa to help elevate Tongan filmmaking. But then, you know, reading the script and realizing how, you know, it was an experience that I went through with my grandmother and just how a lot of the themes, I just know, we know, you know, being a hafakasi, we are always kind of perceived not just by one set of people, but also, you know, like the full Tongans, the New Zealand-born Tongans, and then you get the hafakasi. So it's kind of like we're always like not, it's not like we're trying to prove ourselves, but we know that there's like judgment, so to speak, right? Let's all just, yeah, people are judging, right? So, yeah, there was a lot of these things that I could connect with, and then I was just like, ah, damn it, fine.
Just seeing the journey of the short film to all the film festivals it's been to now, it's an Oscars consideration. Can you tell us how this happened?
There's a process of making the film, and then there's a whole nother life. And we've actually been really fortunate that we have really super onto-it producers, that they have come in that process, and we don't have to worry about all the communication around it, which can be quite full-on. The journey of the film really speaks to the quality of the narrative, but also how it's such a universal issue. You know, this is a Tongan story, but it's a human condition. You know, and that's through like westernization, migration, all of these things. Generally, everyone can connect with at least one aspect of the film. Even, you know, the relationship between just having an elder. You know, I remember someone coming up to me and just going, "Oh man, you've really reminded me that I have to see my, you know, my oldies."
Yeah. Yeah, no, and what was really beautiful, like to jump on that, was when we were in Sundance, we had a community screening and we thought no one would come, and then we like sold out in like a couple of days. We were like, okay, whoa, my gosh, because there's a huge Tongan community in Utah. Obviously, there's like the whole Mormon community and, you know, but Vera and I could not move afterwards because we were just like bombarded with people just wanting to give us a hug and could relate so much, you know, because a lot of them have lost the ability to speak the language. And so being able to see how it directly impacts the audience is a whole nother thing.
What I've really loved about this Oscars campaign is seeing how you've managed to harness the power of people and getting the village to support. So who has come on board so far to really help push this film into the stratosphere?
Oh my gosh, my dear friend Frankie Adams, well, our dear friend Frankie Adams, came on to the project very early, like back in the day when we were like fundraising, and she is our executive producer. So she's been on this journey from the start, and she's just been absolutely amazing. And then we've just announced that Jason Momoa is our other executive producer, which is amazing because, you know, he was kind of like a perfect fit for us. He supports this kaupapa so much and has his own, you know, journey with his own culture and is such a big advocate for Pacifica storytelling. And I was very lucky to work with him on Chief of War. And so, you know, I had to do that thing of like, hey, could you watch our film and would you wanna? And he was just like so supportive and said, I'd love to. How can I help?
What did Jason Momoa say about the film when he saw it?
Oh, he loved it. He loved it so much. He gave me a voice note and yeah, it was awesome. I was always so inspired with Chief of War because it's like, wow, like he's wanted to tell this for so long. He could do any project he wants right now. He could just be like, I want to do this action and this. But this was always like a passion project for him. So that's how I kind of saw Le Tupuanga. I was just like, ah, different scales, but same sentiment. So I think that's why Vera and I like agreed. We're like, he's the best person to come and help support us on this journey.
And that was Ellis Lolohea speaking to Luciane Buchanan and Vera Mafileo, the filmmakers behind Lea Te Puanga or Mother Tongue, who are making a bid for an Oscars run, which will closely follow on their journey.
Well, that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Remember, you can find our stories when you type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. But our team will be back at 6 a.m. PNG time tomorrow, but you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. And coming up after that, it is Nisha Daily. So until next time, o dua a whātum. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.